From the Sky News Centre at 6. Doctors have been giving an update on the condition of the Russian spy who was a victim of the Salisbury nerve agent attack.
He's responding well to treatment, improving rapidly, and is no longer in a critical condition.
That's Dr. Christine Blanchard from Salisbury District. Meanwhile, Sergei Skripal's niece has been denied a visa to come to the UK to see him and his daughter Yulia, who also remains in hospital. The Home Office says the application did not comply with immigration rules. Victoria Skripal says the British must have something to hide. A woman who pretended she was a survivor of the Grenfell Tower fire has been jailed for 4.5 years. 47-year-old Joyce Muzakiri said she lost her husband in a disaster and ended up claiming £19,000. Metropolitan Police Commissioner Cressida Dick has promised extra patrols in response to a spate of violent crime in London.
I need to learn from the rest of the world, but I need to concentrate on London, and that's what we're doing. We've got 300 officers a day extra out over this weekend. We will be using every tactic we know in the coming weeks and months to bear down on knife crime.
There have been more than 50 murders in the capital so far this year. Earlier, a man was arrested on suspicion of killing 17-year-old Tanisha Melbourne Blake, who was shot in Tottenham on Monday night. A man described as having chilling fantasies about murdering the Queen has been jailed for 8 years for attempting to join Islamic State. Always Shike, originally from Somalia, also talked about killing David Cameron. McDonald's is facing a new round of strikes over calls for higher wages. It's understood the Bakers, Food and Allied Workers Union is balloting members over plans for walkouts at 5 different branches. 7 months ago, there was industrial action at 2 of its restaurants. And in sport, England will hope to end the night top of Group 1 in qualifying for the Women's World Cup. Villanova's side looks to make it 4 wins from 4 when they take on unbeaten leaders Wales at Southampton's St Mary Stadium. That's the latest from Sky News Centre. I'm Charlie Max.
Thank you.
BCFM is special.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 6 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Westbury-on-Trim and Henley's, who's just resigned today, Claire Campion-Smith. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Rise and Kill First. Well, it's a book on the bookshelves. I hope it's going to be on your bookshelf. It's a new expose of Israeli assassination programmes since the Second World War, including foreign leaders. Ronan Bergman tells all. Also in international news, Turkey. France must choose Turkey or the Kurds. The Pentagon, US policy is fighting in Syria as unchanged, although we hear US troops are being withdrawn. What's going on? Trump has a phone call with Benjamin Netanyahu, and apparently things are tense over Trump's plans to pull troops out of Syria. Violence in Gaza at the weekend, and also possibly more today as another process going on in Gaza. And of course, the Skripal story. Russia is warning Britain that they'll be sorry over all these, what they say are, fake accusations. That's all in the second hour after 6. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius and light rain, highs of 11, that is over the weekend, light rain and breezy. Next week, highs of 14 Celsius, light rain and breezy too through next week. Next weekend, that's the 14th and 15th of April, highs of 14 Celsius, sunny spells and showers next weekend. That was Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So hopefully joining us on the line now is Claire Campion-Smith. Hi, Claire. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, and hello to all your listeners.
Thank Thanks, Claire. Could you just take us through this decision today to resign as a councillor? I imagine that means there'll be a by-election.
Yes, there will. The reason for resigning is because I've got health problems. They are not desperately severe, but I do want the time and space to, a bit more personal time and space, to keep myself well, because I think that's important. So I've thought about it for quite a bit of time, and I've discussed it with my husband and family, and I think we feel that it's the right time for me to give myself more space.
So tell us a bit about your... I think you've been a councillor for quite a long time. How long?
It's 12 years now. Well, it'll be 12 years in May. So, yes, that is quite a long stint. So it's the equivalent of three terms. And it's been an immensely rewarding experience. So there's a lot that I will miss about it.
Tell us about some of the committees that you're sitting on at the moment and bring us up to date with what's been happening in those areas.
Right. Well, the main committee is the People Scrutiny Committee, and that is operating in a different way at the moment. So I've been chairing the Adult Social Care Task and Finish Group, and that's been really rewarding. So I was desperately trying to finish off the chair's comments this morning for the final draft report. And I hope it'll be a very useful piece of work, because, of course, the way in which we deliver services to older people is crucial. It's a huge budget pressure, so we've got to do it within the right budget framework. But at the same time, the people who've got to be absolutely at the centre of service design are the people who need those services. So it's quite a challenge.
You're sounding quite positive about it. It must be soul-destroying to see so much problems with adult social care.
It can be, but I think there are ways forward, and there are ways forward that I would support, even if we had an enormous amount of money. So the way forward is that we are aiming to keep people as independent as possible for as long as possible. Now, I'm an older person, and that appeals to me greatly. So it's a question of getting the right services in very, very fast, making sure that people have got opportunities within the community for support, rather than rushing in with an enormous great package of care, which isn't appropriate, because people still want to run their own lives. Having said that, we do know that there are people in the city who do need 24-hour, 7x24 care, and even possibly two or three carers in order to cope. So we do have some very expensive packages as well. We've got to be able to pay for it, but for those people who can support themselves with advice, with help when it's needed, and remaining independent as long as possible, I think that's a good alternative.
Don't you think maybe people are being a little bit fobbed off, where they're in the past could and should maybe have been moved earlier into somewhere, a care home, or into a situation anyway where there is somebody permanently in attendance? So if anything goes wrong, they have a fall or something, there's always someone around.
I think that was something that I thought as well. Is this a fancy way? Is this a spin of saying we're not going to give people services? But actually, I don't think it is. And we actually put far more people into care homes and residential homes than other places do. And it's not really what people want, because they become, they lose so many of their skills, both physical and also their skills of being able to cope as well. So I think it's very, very important that social workers and medical staff who are doing assessments are well trained. They shouldn't be thinking about the cost of the package. They should be thinking about, how do we support this person? What are their ambitions? Because most of us, as we get older, do actually want to stay healthy, active, and looking after ourselves as much as we possibly can.
The trouble is, though, of course, that... I'm just going to say that the trouble is the cost of the package has become almost the only item that some officers will say this is the only thing that matters now, because we've got such enormous problems with finance that actually we're just going to give you the cheapest package available.
Well, that's something that we have to keep monitoring and keep under scrutiny, because if that is happening, then, you know, it's going against the culture which we're trying to create. We've got to be able to support people who really need support, and that, I mean, is quite clear. So, I mean, I think that the whole issue of social care funding has got to be tackled at a national level, and it's no good having the drips and drabs coming down. We do need a sense of this is how we're going to fund it, and this is the funding package that we feel will be needed over the next 5, 10 years and so on, so that people can plan and people can put in the necessary infrastructure for social prescribing, assistive technology, whatever is appropriate.
Do you think you can say with a clear conscience that you're stepping away from this, having left adult social care in a good state? And have you had the cooperation of the mayor in this?
Right, I'm not actually in charge of it. I'm just scrutinising it. but I did have responsibility for it about a year ago. And yes, I think it's one of those things that all councillors are supportive of. But it is a question of how we ensure that the language that we speak in the council house, the words that we put into high-level documents and so on, actually is having the right effect for people on the ground. And that has always been a challenge for a councillor, I think. We come to the business of being a councillor knowing that we represent people, and knowing that actually the questions that we should be asking of officers and higher level people is this actually working for my residents? And if we can keep that focus, then A, we will get good services, and that's what we should be trying to do. So, yes, does that make sense?
Yeah, yes. But you were one of the people who was dropped from the cabinet, weren't you? I mean, I just wonder whether you think that that's really actually affected services on the ground.
I don't think so, because I think the officers continued. I think that people understood the philosophy of it. And felt that it was the right philosophy, and therefore it has continued. So these things can carry on, despite the fact that the people there might be some change at the top. But yes, I was dropped from the cabinet. I was very, very disappointed at the time. I think, looking back, I couldn't deliver a docile Liberal Democrat group. But Liberal Democrats have never been docile, so...
So was that just always going to be impossible to do?
I that was slightly tongue-in-cheek. I think that the mayor has made a few mistakes with his cabinet in the sense in which, and I am being very open now, in the sense in which he has got too many new people in, and he doesn't have a balance of experience and new people. So that's just a personal view, because at the same time Mark Bradshaw went when I went, and I think that was sad.
Well, of course, Mark, you know, really, we did want to see through the delivery of Metrobus as well, didn't he? And also, I mean, we hear about all the changes amongst the senior staff at the council, as well as people in the cabinet, because the council has been defending its decision today, Marvin has anyway, to pay a new chief executive director, there's four of them, £165,000 each. Now, it does seem a little bit steep when we're being told that there isn't enough money to go around, that we've also got these new faces. And I wonder, I mean, with all these new people involved, both at cabinet level and on with the council staff, do you think there's any problem with that? Isn't that just what Marvin has to do, really? Any new mayor is going to come in and think, well, at least possibly think, oh, we just need a new broom round here.
That is a temptation, and I have a serious concern leaving the council, that in fact it is in a considerable state of flux. We have had a lot of senior officers leaving, and they've taken with them a lot of good knowledge. And as I said beforehand, I think that balance of experience and new thinking is helpful. But I think we have got too many people who are new to the council. I think the other thing is that I am quite worried for the city about the fact that we don't have a chief exec, because Marvin himself is new to politics. He's never been a councillor, never been an MP. So in one sense, he is new to politics, and that's no bad thing, but it does mean that you really need a strong, experienced chief exec, because that's the balance between the politics and the executive. Marvin is the chief politician, and I think we probably do need a proper chief exec who can hold the reins as far as the officers are concerned.
What Marvin will say, I imagine, is that he, although, you know, it'd be nice to get him on this programme, but he won't reply to our requests at the moment. But what he'll say is that look, these four chief officers, I'm paying £165,000 each, they are actually, in a way, better than a chief exec because they have more brain power between the four of them.
I think that we will have to see how it all pans out. But there is nobody, in a sense, who can say, OK, then I hold the ultimate decision from the officer perspective, and officers... And, I mean, who is going to arbitrate if there is, a disagreement between those four chief officers?
I imagine Marvin. Well, that's his job, isn't it?
Yes, but it's also very useful if you've got an officer there as well.
I wonder whether there's a bit of a Trump syndrome here, someone coming from outside politics. I mean, obviously, Marvin's been involved in the public sector most of his working life, but where someone is maybe a little bit naive in certain ways.
I couldn't really comment on that, except that I don't think he does have the political experience that you gain from being a councillor before moving on to being leader of council or one of those particular roles. And I think that is useful. I think there's something very strange about democracy, and that is that you do have to take a lot of notice of the people, and you've got to persuade them. You've got to listen to them, persuade them, and that takes a bit more time. So people come in wanting to be new brooms, and over my various years, many years, with different experiences, I think that the most helpful thing at a change is somebody who comes in and observes. And when they've observed and when they've understood the system, it's at that point that they're ready to make changes.
We also see there's various sort of things bubbling along at the moment, Claire. I wonder what would be your parting thoughts about the way the arena project, because, I mean, I can remember back in the noughties, there were people like John Savage from Business West, and he was also a member of the Labour Party, constantly banging his fist on the table saying, when are we going to get this bleep bleep arena built?
Right. And we're still saying that, when are we going to get this arena built? There was a motion at full council. I voted for it at Temple Meads because I think it's a better location. I don't think it's an arena at any price, so if we can't get the funding package right, then it may be that we have to delay it for a few more years until we can get the funding right. I'm seriously concerned about it out in the north of Bristol, out at Filton. And I think if planning permission is granted to South Gloucestershire for the extension of the Mall so that we have a big entertainment centre there, then I think it will just take the whole axis of entertainment and so on out of the centre of Bristol and into South Gloucestershire. We don't have the road infrastructure, and I think it will strip Bristol of a vibrant city economy, which is what visitors want and what Bristolians want.
Well, someone will say it's accessible by motorway up there, Claire, and probably will be less congestion as a result.
That is one of the issues to be resolved. But, for instance, I don't drive, so not very accessible for me, is it?
What's your crystal ball? Where do you think it'll actually eventually be built, given that it, you know, if it is going to either arrive at Temple Meads or up at Cribbs?
I think the mayor is thinking in terms of Filton, but I'm just sort of guessing. I think he's thinking of it because it will be a much cheaper proposition, and I don't know how much political pressure people might be able to bring to bear on him to consider the Temple Meads site. So I wouldn't put any money at all on us having an arena in the next few years.
Well, it seems like maybe it's one of those things a bit like HS2 or Hinckley, where everyone is starting to scratch their heads and saying, well, this is all very well, but we haven't got the money for it. Also, just want to get your take on the housing crisis. I'll call it a crisis because we've got something like, according to Councillor Paul Smith, who's in charge of housing, something like 400 people a night, which is about double the official figures, sleeping rough in the centre of the city, which is obviously not an acceptable thing to be happening. I wonder what you make of any possibility of actually dealing with the complete lack of enough of accommodation for people here in the city.
I think it's a very difficult problem, and you can't solve problems that have been steadily building up over 40 years overnight. I think of those people who are sleeping out, there will be a whole range of reasons why it is. So, yes, we do need affordable accommodation. We need the sort of accommodation which is transition accommodation. So it's emergency, but it does mean that with support, people can move into permanent accommodation. So you need a whole range of options in order to solve this particular problem. And in that support, you will need access to good mental health services, and in some cases, you will need access to drug and alcohol services. I mean, I was talking to somebody up in Manchester, and a new drug on the scene is a big problem within the homeless. So it's a whole range of issues that will eventually address the problem, but it's quite true that we do need far more. Relatively small, quite often for single people, relatively small and affordable accommodation, because quite often people drop into homelessness who'd never ever dreamt that it might happen to them because of a marital breakup or because they lose their job and they don't have the financial backup to keep paying for it. So I think it needs to be addressed on so many different levels, and it's not going to be an easy one because it has built up over quite a few years. But sadly, there isn't really enough money in the benefit system to help.
Going back to Marvin, I mean, the same situation, of course, with George Ferguson. He wasn't a politician. You've been through both of these two mayors. How would you compare them?
Oh, now that is a leading question, isn't it? Well, Marvin hasn't got through to the end of his term, so I'm going to dodge that.
What about style of leadership? Because you've seen both in action, haven't you?
Yes, yes. I think Marvin would like to be more collaborative. I think Marvin has formulated quite a lot of his politics in the USA. He doesn't come with the same level of experience that George did, because George had been president of REBA, and he had his
That's
own...
That's the architects, Royal Institute of British Architects, isn't it?
That's right, yes, yes. So he came with a different background, but I think anybody coming from outside the council always finds democracy a challenge because it sort of slows them down. And I think it's very difficult to concentrate on the hard graft of being a leader, especially in a time when you don't have a lot of money. So I think both are rather seduced by being mayors on a global stage. And in reality, what we want at the moment is a lot of concentration on Bristol and a lot of hard graft.
Also, Metro Bus, hopefully. Do you know when it's supposed to be opening, Claire?
It was announced, wasn't it? But I can't remember. Sometime towards the end of May.
It seems to just sort of keep disappearing slightly further back over the horizon.
It's interesting, yes, but they did actually announce a date, and they also said that there would be 10 days of free travel, which I think is brilliant.
Is it going to be any kind of magic bullet? Because there is also talk about introducing this congestion charge. I wouldn't imagine that the Metro Bus is going to make so much difference that that eases any congestion. What do you make of those thoughts?
I'm not really very into this. I mean, one of my big concerns is the quality of air in Bristol. So we do need to be able to provide decent public transport and also to make it possible for people to walk and cycle more. I think the Metro Bus will help. It's the one that is coming in from the east of the city. And from my perspective in Westbury and Henlees, what we really need is some excellent public transport links that are going to come in from the 5,500 new homes that are going to be built on the Filton airfield. Now, if we could get a Metro Bus out there, I mean, we're not going to in a hurry, but if we could get really good public transport out there, then yes, I think it would make a difference because people would travel on it. It'll be different from first buses.
Yeah, well, they're going to be running it, and they were the guys that were running the Croydon tram, which crashed and killed, I think it was something like 7 people, good old First Bus. I can't believe that they even allowed First Bus to bid for this contract.
Well, I wasn't responsible for that.
No, I'm not blaming you, Claire. I'm just expressing a bit of exasperation. I think I might bring in old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, who's been sitting patiently here. Martin, I mean, what is it in the modern British way of managing us, you know, what our government gets up to, that they can actually say, well, even though you caused this crash, and we know it was your fault that the crash happened because you were warned by the drivers and you took no notice, that we think it's fine for you to run our Metro Bus here in Bristol?
I think it's the myth of competition. I mean, when the public transport or buses were privatised in the 1990s, I think it was, I can't remember now, I remember there were loads and loads of I was in Oxford at the time, and there were several companies all competing with each other, buses, empty buses blocking so that other buses could go and pass them and pick up the customers, and then pretty soon it settled down, and you settled down to a stable oligopoly, where you've got First Bus and Virgin and various other big players who basically dominate the market.
That's not really
a competition.
I mean,
it's
I was in Oxford
oligopoly
as well in the 90s, and I can remember the buses racing like at ridiculous speeds, overtaking other buses to try and get to the next bus stop first.
That's right. So there was, and of course, they never allowed that in London because it would have been totally chaotic. I think there's actually a case for having publicly owned public transport, which has never been gainsaid. And of course, we had 13 years of Labour government, and they did nothing about it. And eventually, we will reinvent the wheel, and we probably will have publicly run public transport again, and after it'll take 50 years of nonsense, but then we'll come back to what our grandparents recognised as a sensible way to do it.
Claire?
And of course, I mean, what happens in London is very different from what happens in the rest of the country, and this is what gets me mad. So MPs enjoy all the advantages of Transport for London, and yet, you know, the rest of the country has got to put up with, as you said, this mock competition. And just on a very local issue, we had Wessex and First Bus competing for the route down White Ladies Road. And then First Bus put on a lot of extra buses, saw Wessex off. And what happens then? The service drops. So it doesn't do the passengers any good at all. So we do need more control over what is going on. And as a step forward, I mean, we need some better franchising and some better service contracts as well.
Well, I was looking the other day, it's nearly £5 to get a return to fish ponds. I mean, I don't know if you can persuade people to go to fish ponds. It's not the easiest thing to do. But if you do, it's going to cost nearly a fiver on the first group. I mean, is there anything we can do about them, Claire, at all, with these fares?
We can't do anything about the fares apart from public protest. What they will say to you is, book it on your phone and you can have a £4 day rider.
Oh, that's a good answer.
So that, I think that would be what they would say.
If you can and work out how to do it on your phone, and if your battery doesn't run out just as you're about to step on the bus.
Yes, I agree with you that that is one of the problems. I'm not very good at keeping my battery up. I'm really, really sorry. I didn't realise I was going to be on for quite such a long time. And the dinner's burning.
Oh,
and
gosh.
I've got to go out later.
That's fine. Okay, so, Claire. Well, look, Claire, thanks ever so much for joining us. I wonder if there's any sort of last thoughts you've got about, you know, what some of the memories from the council, and maybe you could say something positive about it. You think something you've managed to achieve over those 12 years?
Well, I think it was putting in all those extra primary school places. I mean, we put in thousands of primary school places. I was a lead member for Children's Services. There was a big bulge in the child population. Interestingly enough, one of the challenges was right at the very beginning, actually getting officers to recognise. They looked at the figures but didn't think school places. And the other thing was trying to get some of the school communities to be willing to expand their schools. Some of them were thinking, oh, we're very happy as a 2-4 entry school. And we were saying, well, actually within the community we have got people, we've got young children who need school places. So you have a responsibility to address community issues. But once we got over some of those hurdles and we started getting money from government as well, well, we came up with some really good buildings. And Redland Police Station is now an infant school.
Well, Claire Campion-Smith, you're the, up until, I would imagine, it's about a few weeks' time, Lib Dem councillor for Westbury on Trim and Henleys. Thanks very much for joining us tonight and for your service to the city over the years.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me.
Now, Martin, another story this week. 100 children stuffing school food in their pockets in case they don't get another meal, we hear this week in the Mirror.
That was from the NUT conference. It's not called the NUT anymore, is it? It's called the Education Union, National Education Union. The school teachers are very aware of the underprivileged lives of some of the children that they work with.
Well, the headline says the teachers are warning of the heartbreaking rise in child poverty. The kids turning up at school with grey skin and stuffing food in their pockets, fearing they won't get another meal. As teachers warn of heartbreaking rise of child poverty. Schools are having to provide essentials to stop poor families falling through the cracks. They say poverty is damaging children's education, describe a daily critical situation of poor pupils as heartbreaking. School leaders described how children are turning up at the school gates showing visible signs of poverty, grey skin, poor teeth, hair and nails. A head from a primary school in Cumbria said she was aware of pupils putting food in their pockets to take home because they're not sure if they're going to get another meal that day.
Well, that's right, and of course it's all happening a million miles away from the cabinet minister's children who don't ever come into contact with these kind of realities.
Or the shadow cabinet, I might.
Well, I think that may be true of some of them, but not entirely so. I mean, I think there is a big split between those who are privately educated, the 7%, so, and the 93% who aren't.
Are those children stealing?
Of the 7%?
No. Are the children stealing food from school?
Well, that's... Well, no, they're not stealing it. I mean, the food's provided for them, but
But they're given a certain amount, but they're grabbing extra and putting it in their pockets.
Well, no, what they're doing is the other thing you just see is that kids have got lots and lots of problems which aren't educational problems. They come in, and I work in schools. You've got children who are coming in with all, you know, with lots of family difficulties, stress and pressure of all sorts of different kinds, and teachers and others end up being social workers, really. But at the same time, there's enormous pressure to deliver the national curriculum, which is a relentless kind of drumbeat, which can get even well-established teachers sacked if they don't achieve the targets that have been set. Meanwhile, of course, they're often dealing with very delicate family situations, children in distress, mental and physical, and none of that's really taken account of in the job descriptions that teachers have.
Well, I've seen very little from Angela Rayner this week about this, which is a pity. I mean, although the teachers are making a big fuss about it last weekend. Labour Party seems to be sort of hamstrung at the moment, doesn't it, with day after day after day having to deal with these accusations of anti-Semitism. I mean, surely, Martin, not all of these accusations can be false.
Well, I'm prepared to have a debate about it if people want to debate, but no crying for mummies if you hear things you don't want to hear. I think we've just seen the big massacre in Gaza over the last week. I would ask all of those people accusing the Labour Party of anti-Semitism, have you got anything to say about the Israeli government killing all these people? Have you got anything to say about that? Because if we're going to talk about anti-Semitism, we better start talking about that. And of course, the recognition of Jerusalem by Trump, our ally, has set the Middle East aflame. And of course, the British position is that they shouldn't do that. When are we going to act on that and do something to stop the Israelis doing what they should be doing? I want to hear that from the Board of British Deputies, British Jews, about that. And I also want to hear, are they going to call on their people to vote Labour? Because in actual fact, in previous elections, they've called on people to vote Conservative. Norman Tebbit turned up at the protest about anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. He's not Jewish. It's nothing to do with him. But he felt he had a right to say something.
He's a right-wing conservative.
He's a right-wing conservative, that's right. And he doesn't like Jeremy Corbyn, and that's why he was protesting. But he's got no Jewish background whatsoever. And, of course, when Jeremy Corbyn went to the Judas group, which is based in his constituency, and he's known them for years, he then gets accused of anti-Semitism for going to a celebration with a Jewish group, because they're the wrong kind of Jewish group, you see. They're a left-wing Jewish group, and as we all know, moderate Jews aren't left-wing, and therefore Jeremy Corbyn shouldn't be hanging around with left-wing
Jews.
Well,
there is some evidence.
It's a bit silly, isn't it?
There is some evidence that social media anti-Semitism has actually been put there by fake accounts.
Indeed. I think I sent you an email about that a couple of nights ago.
One Tory activist called Sheila, which is, and I'll put a link up to this on our show page, posted the disillusioned Labour supporter message into a Facebook page with 95,000 members. She said she was a Labour supporter, she had become disillusioned over anti-Semitism, and she would never vote Labour again. But it turned out that actually, if you go down her timeline, she wasn't a Labour supporter at all. She was a conservative troll. Supporter. So, I mean, and the thing is that some of these comments have just been picked up by national news in London as if they are actually Corbyn supporters, where actually there's no evidence that they could be actually country. And effectively, these people, some of them, are just screen names.
Well, and
they're hitting the headlines.
In actual fact, as you know, Al Jazeera did a sting operation on the Israeli embassy a couple of years ago, and a Mossad officer told the journalist on camera that £1 million was going to be spent inside the Labour Party to get the results they wanted in terms of policy and so on. And I would say to all of those people screaming anti-Semitism, did you take any of that money from the Israeli embassy? Because there's £1 million that was spent. Some of it must have gone somewhere, perhaps to create all kinds of false identities online to push
Martin,
this kind
down
of...
Down at Ground Zero in Gaza, we had, I think it was 17 killed last weekend.
Three today, I heard.
Today,
earlier.
Now it's 7 Palestinians killed and 300 wounded. Now, this idea of the IDF, the Israeli Defence Force, opening fire with live guns and bullets on unarmed civilians is like a Bloody Sunday type situation we had in Northern Ireland in the 70s and 60s and 70s.
It is, although what's happened is that the mainstream media in the West has largely ignored the whole thing. If it was happening in Syria, we'd have heard all about it and we'd be demanding an airstrike. In fact, somebody was killed by an Israeli airplane today. When are we going to put in the no-fly zone to stop the Israelis using their air power against defenceless civilians, like in Libya, and suggestion to be the same in Syria? The fact of the matter is that many of the people in Gaza used to live where the Israelis have put loads of settlements on the other side of that line. They literally used to live right there. So when they try and march through that fence, they're trying to go back where they used to live. And of course, since there is no two-state solution on the table, one of the protest organisers, reading back what he was saying today, said, well, we want a one-state solution. We're all going to live together, Israelis and Palestinians. Rip this fence down. We're coming back where we used to live, and we'll have have to negotiate, you'll have to move, because we used to live there. And of course in Bosnia, that's exactly what we insisted on, that the Serbs weren't to take land off other communities which they claim was theirs and so on. And we went to war with Serbia and we bombed them for 40 days and we killed 10,000 civilians. And incidentally, Sharon, who was the Prime Minister of Israel at that time, didn't support NATO's intervention over Kosovo because he recognised immediately that it set a precedent. Well, and if we're going to invade Libya to get rid of Gaddafi, maybe we're going to have to go to war with Israel to make them obey the rules that we set
back
down.
Back in 2002, Martin, there was a former Israeli education minister, Shulamit Aloni, was on Amy Goodman, wasn't she, talking about the idea of using anti-Semitism as a trick. She said, we always do it. So let's have a listen to that clip now from 2002. This is Shulamit Aloni, former Israeli education minister.
Often when there is dissent expressed in the United States against policies of the...
This is actually Amy Goodman introducing her.
...you're called anti-Semitic. What is your response to that as an Israeli Jew?
Well, it's a trick. We always use it. When from Europe somebody is criticizing Israel, then we bring up the Holocaust. When in this country people are criticizing Israel, then they are anti-Semitic. And the organization is strong and has a lot of money. And the ties between Israel and the American Jewish establishment are very strong, and they are strong in this country. As you know, they have power, which it's okay. They are talented people, and they have power, money, and media, and other things. And their attitude is Israel, my country, right or wrong, the identification. And they are not ready to hear criticism. And it's very easy to blame people who criticize certain acts of the Israeli government as anti-Semitic and to bring up the Holocaust and the suffering of the Jewish people. And that justifies everything we do to the Palestinians.
Well, that's a moment of candour, is it not? Of course, we're going to look at this book later in the second hour, where they basically boast about the 2,500 people they've assassinated since 1948. All completely illegal, of course, but never mind, they can do it because they're Israel. I would say what we've got to do is compare Israel to a country like Serbia. Serbia's way down the pecking order. They did certain bad things in the 1990s in former Yugoslavia, and we went to war with them. We put in a no-fly zone and we went to war with them. Israel does pretty much the same things, and we just bend over backwards to say, well, you can't really blame the Israelis. I say the Israelis are exactly the same as the Serbs. One rule for the Serbs, one rule for the Israelis, one rule for the British, one rule for everybody, and we've got to make it stick.
Okay, Martin. Also, just looking around at some of the other stories this week, there was one clip I saw, and this was on Wales Online, and it was a fascinating article about an encounter that South Wales chief reporter, I'm not sure which newspaper it is because it's called Wales Online on the internet. He says, what faith can one have in a political leader? And he's talking about Theresa May here, who wants to know all the questions she will face in advance. And it's his article is called What Happened When I Met Theresa May by Martin Shipton. He said, we had to submit one question for Theresa May in advance of her Wales visit. And this is what happened. His chief reporter was given the chance to quiz the Prime Minister. First of all, Martin, I would say just as a journalistic principle that you shouldn't give the questions beforehand. We never do here on this programme. Nobody gets the questions beforehand because that enables them to pass those questions on to somebody else to come up with a prepared answer. And we want to actually see whether they're able to think on their feet, surely.
Well, I mean, I would tend to agree with you, but if we are going to have questions in advance, then it's got to be questions in advance for everybody. But I think if you look at Jeremy Corbyn, chats to who is in front of him. he does take advice, and you know, sometimes he says things that are out of line, and he perhaps be wiser not to say them. But on the whole, he's perfectly prepared to talk to anybody. And I think if you look at his election campaign compared to Theresa May, you'll see what the difference was. He went out and met people and talked to them. Theresa May had an entourage which wouldn't let anybody speak to.
Well, Theresa May was in a community centre over in South Wales, and locals were actually excluded from the place. Tory activists from all across South Wales held up placards describing Mrs. May as strong and stable. A lot of journalists were in the audience, only a select few were allowed to ask questions. He said he'd be asking about the single market, but he didn't mention that he'd be asking the Prime Minister about a covertly taped meeting she had with Goldman Sachs employees a month before the referendum, in which she had expressed fears that companies would close down factories and relocate if the European Union left the EU. When he asked her what had changed her mind since the Goldman Sachs vote, she waffled unconvincingly. So he managed to get actually a bit of a sort of supplementary question in there.
Yeah,
and she couldn't really answer it.
Well, I think that, you know, that's up to her. If she doesn't want to answer direct questions, that's up to her. But then, of course, we're going to say you're not answering direct questions. Are you fit to be running the country? Because you can't actually run your own answers to questions.
She told me I was the only press journalist from Wales who'd be asking a question. Amazing that this is supposed to be some sort of like get to know the Welsh people. A few minutes passed, he says, and I was asked to follow her along the corridor. Surprised that the other journalists didn't come with me, but ushered into another similarly sized room where I could see around five other people, including the Prime Minister. Where were the other journalists? He shook hands with Mrs. May and sat down. Within a second or two, it was clear that there wouldn't be any kind of speech and that the others weren't there as reporters to the interview. He said to the Prime Minister, "My go, is it?" She responded, "It is, unless you thought I was going to ask you questions," cueing laughter from all those rest of them around the table. So, I mean, it just sounds like a completely stage-managed event.
Well, it's control freakery, which is all very well, unless people expose the control freakery. It's like the Wizard of Oz when you pull the curtain back and you realise it's just a little guy talking into a megaphone. And I think that kind of approach has not served the Tory party very well. But if you look at things like Cambridge Analytica, which were raided by the police the other week, the idea that you can manipulate public opinion if you've got sufficiently professional PR is very, very prevalent.
I suppose they're thinking, well, it's a newspaper journalist, we can just do what we want, it won't be filmed or anything.
Yeah. Well, the idea is the control freakery of spin doctors and so on and so forth. But of course, what Corbyn did is both in his campaigns within the Labour Party and during the election campaign, he blew that out of the water, because you've got loads of people who want to speak to him. When he came here to Easton, when he was campaigning to be Labour leader, as soon as people realised he was in the area, he was mobbed by hundreds of people, and that was totally spontaneous. Nobody planned it. Nobody knew he was coming, and I think that shows the difference between him and her.
Also, are there any other stories this week you'd like to bring up?
Well, you put me on the spot there. I'll have to think about the stuff I've been looking at. I think one of the
I'd like to talk about, if you don't mind, is the incredible rising crime of London. The statistic that we've had something like 50 murders in London, more than in New York so far this year. The Metropolitan Police is run by somebody called Cressida Dick at the moment, who was the woman in charge of the murder of John Charles de Menezes, and yet now she's Chief Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police.
Well, the Metropolitan Police anti-terrorists, Rob, were also shipped out to Salisbury in short order to elbow the Wiltshire Police out of the way on that little the Metropolitan Police are the most politicised of all the police forces in the country, and I think we need to get a bit of perspective. Of course, it's terrible that we've got all these murders going on in London, but it's actually reduced from what it was previously in previous years.
Well, it's
gone up. It's gone up recently, but it went down a lot before it went up again.
It's interesting that this kind of thing can happen almost without you noticing it creep up on you. Most of it is gangland violence of one sort or another.
Well, it's also related to
poverty.
I would argue no. It's gang culture, partly, but a lot of it. But it's also related to the illegality of the drug. drugs market, because people can't settle scores other than with violence. You can't report people who steal drugs off you to the police. And that, of course, is a big problem in Mexico, where tens of thousands of people have been killed in the last 2-3 years. And, of course, what's going to happen gradually is London's going to become more like New York. New York's going to become more like Mexico City, and Mexico City's going to become more like Bogota. That's the future. That's where we're going, because the international drugs trade is bigger than ever. The banking system's totally dependent on it. And, of course, the intelligence services of the West, including the CIA, up to their eyeballs in it. And if we were serious about ending it, then we'd have to arrest people like Colonel Oliver North, who was a major drug dealer in the 1980s for Reagan. He should be in prison. He should probably have been executed under existing US law, but he hasn't been.
Why are the Met not dealing with this gang crime, and with particularly with young people who are carrying weapons, mostly knives? Listen, even some, obviously, have got access to guns.
I've got many criticisms to make of the Metropolitan Police, including the fact that they are, you know, but the most politicised of the police forces that we have and all the rest of it. But with the best will in the world, a 16-year-old who wants to kill another 16-year-old, it's actually quite easy to kill
people.
So why
is this happening so much more at the moment, then?
It's happening a bit more at the moment, but a few years ago it was happening a lot more, and then it came down. What happens is that you get waves of this, yeah?
Okay,
you get
waves of it. When have we had another April where there's been 50 murders?
I think if you look at the figures, I haven't got the computer in front of me, but I read an article yesterday or the day before, and it pointed out that in actual fact, the crime in London... murder was higher some years ago, and then it went down, and now it's creeping back up again. That's the sort of thing that happens. I think the reality is that a lot of people are living on the edge. The illegal drugs market creates the motivation for killings, but I think at the same time, what you've got is a real problem for the police and for society, is it's actually quite easy to kill people. If you've got the motivation, you can kill people. And of course, a lot of young people are you know, trapped in the situation where they feel that they have to carry weapons because others are carrying weapons and so on.
Well, that means surely they're insecure for whatever reason. The police aren't doing their job. I mean, it's, you know, this is,
well, I mean, you could argue,
at the end of the day, Cressida Dick has surely got to take the rap for this. It's no one else's fault that the murder rate is going up.
I've got many criticisms to make of the police and the Metropolitan Police in particular, but also there's a general hoo-ha. This sort of thing has been going on forever. It's not gone away. It's getting a bit worse now. It might get a bit better. It might get a bit worse.
I think we just have to have a difference of opinion there.
Well, no. Murders go on all the time.
I'm not saying they don't, but this rate of killings in London is, at least according to the Evening Standard, higher than ever.
Higher than ever, Tony. And some years back, it was actually higher than it is now. The fact is that people want to make an issue out of this because they want to make an issue out of it. It's a terrible situation.
Nothing to see here. Move.
No. It's a terrible situation. People need to ask themselves questions about cutting of youth services and all of the austerity that we've been going through. Where are the youth leaders that are inspiring young people? They've all been sacked so that we can keep the bankers in the style to which they become accustomed, and they can carry on sending their kids. When they borrow money to go to university, which they don't need, they can have skiing holidays, and that's where the money's gone.
One of the better points I heard being made was that actually, for a lot of young family or young parents with their children, they simply don't have time. They're out working such a lot that they don't have the time to spend with the youngsters.
Well, that's the other thing, of course, because what we do in schools now, because of the league tables and all the rest of it, kids who aren't going to do very well get kicked out, and then they wander the streets looking for trouble. And they've said, why are they wandering the streets looking for trouble? Because they've been kicked out of school because they're going to mess up the league tables. Who brought in the league tables? Who bailed out the banks? Who squeezed the public sector down to nothing so there's no youth workers? Hang on a minute, it was Metropolitan Police, was it? I don't think it was.
Is it in by 2020, are we going to have really no public services left? Is it the idea that government is dissolved and big corporations are running the country?
Well, that would be the wet dream of people like Liam Fox and Rees-Mogg. I think what's going to happen is there's going to be another crash, and then people are going to realise, oh my goodness, the government's the only thing between me
and disaster. Are there any indications of that crash?
I think if you look at the stock markets, you will see that they're wobbling around because of all this trade war with China stuff. And of course, that gets baked into the pie straight away. As soon as people realise that a real trade war with China is on, the markets are going to crash. It may be that Brexit will cause a specific crash in Britain, but something is going to crash it. And then suddenly people will realise there's a tiny minority of people here who've got all of their money locked up in the Cayman Islands. That's our money, which we should be spending on youth work, housing and all the rest of it. But it will take a big shock before people realise that they're going to have to do that. And of course, the other thing that will have to happen is that the middle class who've made money on their house prices will have to lose all of that money before they realise that they're on the same side as everybody else.
The father of a teenager who will never recover after being stabbed in a dispute with a classmate blamed dysfunctional families and poor schooling for rising violence in London. Jamel Boyce was 17 when he was stabbed in the leg and heart in an attack believed to have happened after a minor argument in 2016. The shy and loving business student was left in a vegetative state and needs constant care in a specialist unit. Police say they do not believe he will ever recover. Although surely that should be doctors saying that, but the police have said it. His father, Patrick Boyce, waded into the debate on the rise in London killings, believed to be connected to gang crime. He says the number of stabbings is the highest since 2010. Oh, so you're right, actually.
That's right.
And the Metropolitan Police Force has launched 55 separate murder investigations since the start of 2018. Mr. Boyce, who is now raising money to help with his son's medical care, he said starts with the parents. Parents need to take control of their children, he said to the BBC. It's like demons have taken over the youth of today.
Yes, well, some parents don't take on their responsibilities, and therefore the kids don't have the things that they should have. And therefore somebody else better take on those responsibilities. Youth leaders, for example. We've been cutting youth clubs, all of the things where we should be, you know, bringing people together and helping them. That's all been cut to the bone, so that we can pay off the debt which the banks got us into. And of course, over time, that causes social stress. And of course, the other thing is that the police haven't got the resources they need either. If they were on this programme, I'm sure that's exactly what they'd say.
Mothers may be working 14, 16 hours a day. He's coming home and then there's no one there. So the streets become his family. They find comfort in each other because they gel together. Schools are letting them down. Families are letting them down. And they perceive that by being in a gang, they're stronger. They're someone. But it's a negative path for any teenager. The problem, of course, as well, Martin, is lack of jobs for young people once they leave school.
Yes, and of course, once you've got a criminal record, your chance of getting a job becomes even less. So at that point, you know, the die is truly cast for many of these kids. And, you know, that there is an underclass developing in this country as a result of all of the things that have gone on over the last 30 or 40 years, but it's nothing like what goes on in the United States of America. And what goes on in the United States of America is nothing like what goes on in Colombia and Mexico. But we're all going to go down this drain step by step. We need to have a serious discussion about drug legalization, because that underpins an awful lot of this. But also, it's just a matter of culture. We're not prepared to make the resources available to look after young people with difficulties and problems. They're way down the hierarchy. We're quite prepared to build prisons to lock them up, but to help them to try and find the right way in life, there's no money for that. And that's because of austerity, totally unnecessary austerity imposed on us by people whose kids live a million miles away from any of this and never come into contact with it.
And the Independent today is reporting that Theresa May is absent while violent crime is surging in London. That's coming from Labour MPs. She doesn't really seem to intervene much on this particular point. Do you think that's because you think it's a kind of made-up story?
Well, the fact of the matter is we've got a police force which is supposed to stop people killing each other, and they're paid quite a lot of money to do it, and there's all sorts of difficulties and reasons why it happens, but it's not something that politicians can wave a magic wand and resolve. I'll tell you where there isn't a lot of murder of this sort. It's in Northern Ireland, because the community's police themselves, but it's on a paramilitary basis. Is that what we want?
Well, probably not, no. Finally, religious leaders are attacking the two-child benefit cap, warning that women could face the choice between abortion or poverty. The policy is expected to tip an estimated extra 200,000 children into poverty. So they're saying if you have more than two children, no benefits.
Yes, and what that means is that third child, or the three children, or the four children, or whoever in that family, they're more likely to end up on the streets, aren't they? They're more likely to end up killing each other. They're more likely to end up stealing things and using drugs. I mean, I think the idea...
Does anyone listen to religious leaders like this anymore? Don't answer that, because we've got the news coming up. Time for the Murdoch News at 7. Thanks to our guest Lib Dem Councillor for Westbury on Trim and Henley's Claire Campion-Smith. Join us after the news.
Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.